Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Abolishing death. A thrilling thought. For all that, he wasn't the first person on or off a subway to have it desperately. Turning life back like a clock in the fall, just taking it down off the wall and winding it back until your dead all appear like standard time.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We just heard a passage from Philip Roth's favorite novel of his from 1995, Sabbath's Theater, read by Liev Schreiber. Philip Roth died on May 22, 2018. Today we're going to look at Roth's remarkable contributions to literature in books like American Pastoral, The Ghostwriter, and the book that absolutely changed his career, Portnoy's Complaint. Philip Roth published some of his earliest stories in The New Yorker in the late 50s, and in his following 30-odd books, Philip was many things: a realist, a satirist, a postmodernist, a writer about lust, identity, Jewishness, the self. And as he entered his 60s, he became one of the great chroniclers of the 20th century in America. Roth's writing provided a vision of life during and after the Great War, and he portrayed the chaos created by the conflict in Vietnam. He even anticipated the rise of a Trump-like figure in the form of Charles Lindbergh in his book The Plot Against America. He was always thinking about what made America what it is, which we talked about in 2003.
Times aren't shocking if they're the finely modulated distinctions. You know? Mm-hmm. Times are shocking when there's a great clash of things in a society. Life during the French Revolution was shocking. Do you know Chaffour, the great French epigrammist? Mm-hmm. He said during the Revolution, you'd have to eat a live toad for breakfast in order not to run into something more disgusting during the course of the day. Well, that's true of that decade I'm writing about, too. What was disgusting that was going on in Vietnam was incredibly disgusting because of the confusion about the cause, right? Not to mention the means being used.
My conversation with Philip Roth will be later in the hour, but first we're going to hear from Blake Bailey, who's hard at work on Roth's biography. Bailey has written a number of literary biographies, including one of John Cheever. Like so many things with Philip, the story starts in or around Newark, New Jersey. Now Roth is born in 1933 in Newark. What was the world that he was born into? What were the surroundings like at the time? What is the milieu that that helped create both his obsessions and his personality?
Well, I mean, he lived in the Weequahic section of Newark, which was 96% Jewish, I think. And he felt very safe and secure and had, for the most part, a very happy childhood. You know, Herman's work as a Metropolitan Life insurance agent was very tough in those early years. He was working 6 days a week, and he was, you know, selling burial insurance, which was like 25 cents a week or less, pennies.
Herman was Roth's father.
Yes. So there was a certain amount of financial insecurity in the house, but I think it was a happy household. Bess Roth was a very competent homemaker. However, he became more and more aware, especially during the war, that, you know, there was, you know, very virulent anti-Semitism out there. And in the 30s, you know, the decade of his childhood was the most anti-Semitic decade in American history.
How did he feel it in living in a neighborhood that's 96% Jewish?
He would feel it when Herman would listen to Father Coughlin, the notorious anti-Semitic radio priest, talking about the Jewish warmongering banking interests.
This is on the radio, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the only time he ever heard Herman use profane language. He would hear it when he, you know, drove through Irvington or Union, these environs of Weequahic of Newark. And see gatherings of the German Bund, And again, Herman would expostulate. So he became aware of that. And of course, during the war, he became more and more aware of what was happening in Germany.
Now, Roth publishes Goodbye Columbus, which makes him famous to a degree. And after that, his real breakthrough book comes 10 years later with Portnoy's Complaint. And we've talked with others, with friends of Philip's, and I never knew this, that Philip in some way, even though that book made him, was a huge bestseller, made him both famous and notorious, he in many ways regretted the publication of Portnoy's Complaint. To some degree, it ruined his life.
I mean, he often said, certainly in light of his later achievement, he said, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't have published that book. But let's also bear in mind, okay, that Portnoy's Complaint, when it was published in 1969, it was the best-selling novel in Random House history. It sold 420,000 copies in hardback. It outsold The Godfather in 1969, and it sold, within 5 years, almost 4 million copies in paperback. It was far, far and away Roth's most successful book, and who knows how Roth's later career would have gone had it not been for that the sort of world fame that followed from that book. So that needs to be borne in mind. In Random House, Jason Epstein at Random House was saying this is going to be the biggest book in history.
Why would Jason Epstein think it would be the biggest book in history? What would give him that idea? Because of the sex part?
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, the New York Times was very straightforward when explaining 6 weeks before publication day why this is a guaranteed bestseller. They wrote, "The preponderance of masturbation." Okay, that was a very novel element in American fiction at the time. But what made it such a big deal was that Philip had published, beginning in 1967, he had published four long excerpts to Portnoy, and they had caused a sensation. Now, the biggest one, arguably, was a second one titled Whacking Off.
This was in Esquire, right?
No. The first one was in Esquire. Whacking Off, he deliberately gave to published in, the temple of high modernism, Partisan Review. And so Whacking Off appears in Partisan Review, and like the 8th Street bookstore can't keep the summer 1967 Partisan Review in stock. You know, I mean, people are lining up outside. But the worst part, of course, was that in the reviews, I mean, Brendan Gill and The New Yorker, Time Magazine, everyone was treating this as a confession, and they were equating Portnoy with Philip Roth. So he was famous, as he liked to say, I'm famous as a jerk-off artist. I'm not famous as a novelist.
And it drove him out of New York. Portnoy's Complaint, the attention was so intense, and the jokes on the street were so wearying after a while, it drove him to the Connecticut countryside, didn't it?
It did. At first, he was seeing a very nice young woman named Barbara Sproul at the time, and they rented a house together in the mountains of Woodstock, New York. And Philip was, again, people may think, looking at the jacket photos, or perhaps they've seen an interview, that Philip is this very grim, tough guy. But Philip is very vulnerable and very sensitive. And he was traumatized by what had happened in New York. And so Barbara is kind of trying to talk him down from this, okay? And they're walking one day along some mountain road in the woods, around Woodstock. And she's saying, "Philip, you need to calm down. Look where we are. We're fine. Nothing's going to touch you here." They hear this car in the distance, coming along the mountain road. The car comes abreast of them, slows down, the window rolls down, and they go, "It's Portnoy!"
Let's hear a little from Portnoy's Complaint.
"Because to be bad, Mother, that is the real struggle. To be bad and to enjoy it. That is what makes men of us boys, Mother. But what my conscience, so-called, has done to my sexuality, my spontaneity, my courage, never mind some of the things I try so hard to get away with, because the fact remains, I don't. I am marked like a roadmap from head to toe with my repressions. You can travel the length and breadth of my body over superhighways of shame and inhibition and fear. See, I am too good too, Mother. I, too, am moral to the bursting point, just like you. Did you ever see me try to smoke a cigarette? I look like Betty Davis. Today, boys and girls not even old enough to be bar mitzvahed are sucking on marijuana like it's peppermint candy, and I'm still all thumbs with a lucky strike. Yes, that's how good I am, Mama. Can't smoke, hardly drink, no drugs, don't borrow money or play cards, can't tell a lie without beginning to sweat as though I'm passing over the equator. Sure, I say fuck a lot, but I assure you, that's about the sum of my success with transgressing.
Blake, you know, a funny thing happens in writers' careers or artists' careers. There's the apprenticeship, there's the development, there's the prime work, the originality, if they're lucky, if they're colossal talents. And then there's the kind of falling off, the self-imitation and the falling off. Roth's career is completely different in the sense that you could argue that in the Portnoy period, there was this explosion, and then there's a middle period exemplified by The Ghost Rider.
Right.
And then there's a later period where there's a run of novels, particularly about the theme of America, American Pastoral, I Married a Communist, The Human Stain, and more, really. And then his very favorite novel, Sabbath Theater. Where did the juice come from? The capacity to invent and then reinvent and raise the stakes all the time?
Well, you know, it kind of chagrined Philip that, for example, his sometime rivalrous but very pleasant acquaintance, John Updike, was writing the Rabbit novels, for example, and they were deeply researched, fastidiously detailed representations of American life of, you know, a given era from decade to decade. And he wanted to do something like that. But he said, you know, these other guys, they shine their light out into the world while I'm shining mine down into this little hole. You know, it's right. It's always sort of Zuckerman's problems and so on. His career, his Jewishness, his inner life. Around the time he was struggling to finish My Life as a Man, 1973, let's say, he wrote the first pages of American Pastoral about Swede Lvov, the great Jewish sports hero of Wequeyoc, who goes on to live the American dream, marries Don Lvov, a Gentile Miss America contestant, and they have a daughter, and he's very successful in his glove-making business and so forth, and the daughter is radicalized and becomes a terrorist and blows up the general store. And this is his great novel of the 60s, and it's his first masterpiece of the American trilogy that he wrote in the 90s. He had those, say, 60 pages that he had written in the early 70s. And he knew, and really, if you see these pages, the core episodes of what would become American Pastoral are all there. And he would always, after every book he finished, he would go back to those pages because this, he knew, this material was the opportunity to transcend the merely personal. And finally, he found a way to do it.
You know, you know this as well, that even a colossus of contemporary writing can have an uncertain fate into the future. There are writers that seemed enormous in their time, and then 50 years later or even less, something else happens. They disappear from the syllabus. They disappear from consciousness. And some occupy the opposite. They occupy a large place in the canon as we go forward and people read them. What do you think will happen with Philip Roth's novels going into the future?
I'm pretty optimistic. You know, I mean, Philip was one of the, I mean, for a while, he was the only living American writer in the Library of America. He eventually had 10 volumes. That's kind of as concretely canonical as you can get. His achievement is so diverse. You know, he did so many different things. He did the comical novels. He did the early Jamesian letting go novel. He did sort of the naturalistic Flaubertian When She Was Good. He all sorts of theoretical Kant words, you know, he did the postmodern stuff. He did the metafictional stuff, the counter life, and so on. And then he does these sprawling, beautifully reported, dense portraits of American life in the post-war era, and so on. And then these very incisive, elegiac looks at human mortality toward the end of his career. So there's such a breadth of achievement there. So many themes, so many approaches from a genius writer, I mean, who I rank with Faulkner. And certainly the French rank him with Faulkner. Philip is bigger, arguably, in France than he is here. So, I think Philip will wear well over time.
Blake Bailey, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
Our class started high school 6 months after the unconditional surrender of the Japanese, during the greatest moment of collective inebriation in American history. And the upsurge of energy was contagious. Around us, nothing was lifeless. Sacrifice and constraint were over. The depression had disappeared. Everything was in motion. The lid was off. Americans were to start over again, en masse, everyone in it together. If that wasn't sufficiently inspiring, the miraculous conclusion of this towering event, the clock of history reset, and a whole people's aims limited no longer by the past, there was the neighborhood. The communal determination that we, the children, should escape poverty, ignorance, disease, social injury and intimidation, escape above all insignificance. You must not come to nothing. Make something of yourselves.
That was Liev Schreiber reading from American Pastoral. Before that, we heard from Blake Bailey. His biography of Roth will be published, well, when it's done, he thinks around 2021.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.